welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, Ricky Gies, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Recorded at the Alaska Resource Development Council in Anchorage, his talk entitled Angling for Controversy is coming up next on KSKA, after the news. This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans. This week's program was recorded at an Alaska Resource Development Council breakfast in Anchorage on May 17th.
Good morning. And welcome to the last RDC breakfast of 2011 and 2012. And before we get rolling, I would like to thank so many of you for your tremendous attendance this year. It is greatly noted and appreciated by all. Joining me at the head table this morning, Mr. Jeff Foley with Calista Corp, Tim Gallagher with HDR, another member that was of service to our country for many years, Ricky Gies, who I'll introduce a little bit later, Pat Carter with Carter and Associates, and Mr. Rick Rogers. Well, Ricky is the executive director of the Kenai River Sports Fishing Association, a position he's held since 2004, so 8 years on the job now, so you know where every great hole is. Prior to joining this great association, he worked as executive director of the Kenai Convention and Visitors Bureau for 2 years and as the museum manager for the Kenai Visitor and Culture Center for 4 years. From 1992 to 1997, he was a park ranger at Kenai Fjords National Park in Seward. Ricky served on numerous nonprofit and fishery boards and commissions. He holds bachelor's and master's degree in biology from Stanford University and has a 4-acre certificate in nonprofit management. He also serves on the RDC Board of Directors, and it's always great when we have one of our board members willing to come up and speak with us. He and his wife, Bunny Swan, live in Kenai. Please help me welcome Ricky, and again, thanks to his dad for bringing him up here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about a few things today. They were asking me what a catchy title would be, so I thought Angling for Controversy might be an appropriate one. So I'm going to talk about six different things today, try and breeze through them here. Kenai River Sport Fishing, we're a leader in fishery conservation. Talk a little bit about the Kenai River, what makes it a world-class resource for sport fishing. Sport fishing, it's kind of an upstart fishing industry in Alaska, tremendous growth in the last 30 years. And then I'm going to move into a couple different topics that I thought might be of interest to the Resource Development Council. One is the idea that resource management councils, the fisheries model in Alaska, might be appropriate for other resources in Alaska. I want to talk a little bit about wise use, the ethic of conservation versus, which is a long-held ethic for fish and game management in North America, versus kind of a newer model, which is the no-use environmentalism model. And talk about how that impacts not only just Alaska, but also on the Kenai River. And then talk about growing pains in the sport fishery, our future needs. So let's talk a little bit about my organization, Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. We're a 501c3 charitable nonprofit. Mr. Penny, who is one of the original founders of the RDC, founded Kenai River Sport Fishing Association about in 1984. So we've had a long track record of success. Our Kenai River Classic fundraising events, we've raised over $10 million through the years. We've put it into four main areas in the Kenai: angler access projects and habitat restoration, fisheries management, habitat, fisheries, economic research, and angler education. In terms of angler access and habitat restoration, we're probably one of the greenest groups in Alaska. Many of the angler access areas along the Kenai River have been part of our projects that we've been worked on. from Jim's Access all the way up in Cooper Landing to the Russian River Ferry area where you see the stairways, down to Bing's Landing in the Middle River, to the Lower River, Swiftwater Park. The first one that we did was at the Soldotna Classic Fish Walk behind the Soldotna Visitor Center. We helped put in, get the idea and push to get the pillars in, which is getting a lot of traffic these days. We were also instrumental in helping get Eagle Rock as part of the, in part of state parks these days. So when you go up and down and you're getting on and off the rivers, the Kenai, we've been instrumental in many of these projects. Fisheries management, we work at the Alaska Board of Fisheries. We've been instrumental in making sure that in Upper Cook Inlet, sport and personal use anglers have a predictable opportunity to catch meaningful numbers of fish. We've been trying to work with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council on the halibut issue, making sure that anglers continue to have an opportunity to catch historical bag limits for halibut. We work on habitat, fisheries, and economic research. In terms of habitat, it's pretty amazing. We've got some people who do road systems around here across the state. And there's a crossing of green infrastructure with our rivers and our gray infrastructure with our roads. And it's amazing that nobody before had ever done the research to say that a perch culvert may block fish passage. And we were one of the groups who were looking at that saying, it's kind of obvious, but until you prove it scientifically, it doesn't really count, according to DOT. So we were one of the groups that worked to help prove that when you have a perched culvert, it does actually block juvenile fish passage. On the Kenai, we've been assisting Fish and Game in trying to more accurately account for king salmon. The cost of king salmon monitoring is pretty amazing. It costs about $1 million a year just to operate the sonar, king salmon sonar counter and research projects on the Kenai River. And we've been helping and assisting and trying to get better and better at that. We've done economic research. We were one of the first groups to put out economic information on the salmon values for Upper Cook Inlet for our personal use, sport, commercial, and subsistence fisheries. And in terms of angler education, we have a wide range of programs that we do. Hooked on Fishing, my dad back here spends countless hours in the wintertime refurbishing rods and reels that we get from donations from local people, and then we put it out to youth groups and youth at different events so that the next generation of anglers can come up and enjoy the world-class resource that we have. What makes the Kenai River so special? Well, it's probably the greatest sport fishing river anywhere in the world. Nowhere else do you get the opportunity to catch world-class salmon. Eight of the top 10 world-class salmon that were caught on rod and reel come from the Kenai River. Sockeye salmon is a major fishery along the Kenai. It's the most abundant fish that comes back to the Kenai, and it's although we're famous for the large king salmon, most Alaskans, if they're fishing the Kenai, the most harvested species is sockeye salmon, both in the in the rod and reel fishery and in the dip net fishery. So it's most. You can also fish for silver salmon, and also rainbow trout. And then when you pair that up with the halibut trips out of Seward, Homer, and Deep Creek, really for a one-week period of time, anywhere in the world could come here and have just outstanding opportunities. So the Kenai is the most popular sport and personal use fisheries in Alaska. We get, in Alaska, typically you might get 2.5 million angler days. About 10 to 15% of those will happen on the Kenai River. We get the most personal use fishery days. There's about 30,000 permits, primarily in South Central here from the Kenai, but a majority from Anchorage and the Matsu come down and use the resident-only personal use fisheries. And it's estimated that we take about 4 million pounds of sockeye salmon out of the Kenai River on an annual basis, Alaska residents. So in some ways, I would call it the largest single use of a natural resource by residents in the state of Alaska, outside of our permanent dividend. There are heavy all that use makes heavy demands on angler access and infrastructure. It's one of the reasons why our organization exists. And we're going to continue to make improvements and advocate for angler access and infrastructure improvements. All this activity is a key economic driver for the community there. In terms of tourism, it's the number one, sport fishing is the number one activity that draws people to the Kenai Peninsula in terms of tourism. In terms of retail, Fred Meyer in Soldotna in July, highest grossing Fred Meyer in the country for a 1 month basis anywhere for the whole year. It's pretty amazing. Some years, about half the sport fishing licenses, I think, are sold in the Kenai-Soldotna area. It's also important, that draw, the ability to get outdoors and enjoy fishing and hunting opportunities, is really making the Central Peninsula and the Cooper Landing area attractive for retirees. And along with that, we've attracted one of the best hospitals, I think, in Alaska. The Central Peninsula Hospital has really grown. There's over 600 employees at the Central Peninsula Hospital now. It's one of the largest employers that we have in the peninsula. In terms of real estate property values along the Kenai River, it's about $1 billion worth of retail value, about 40 miles of river. The first 4 miles are the industrial zone on the Kenai. We have about $10 million worth of fish processing plants in about four properties down there. And then we also, the remaining upper 36 miles between the Warren Ames Bridge and up to Skelak Lake, about $1 billion worth of property values there. I don't think any other river in Alaska has near that amount of value in terms of real estate property. A couple other things that are interesting to the Kenai. The Kenai River Center was spearheaded joint efforts. We were part of that effort to get that established, and it streamlined permitting. A lot of times people will go try and get a permit. They'll have to go 3, 4, 5, 6 different places. In your industries, you probably have to go to 30, 40, 50 different places to get permits to do something. The idea of the Kenai River Center was that it'd be a one-stop shop. Property owners, landowners along the Kenai could go one place and get one permit and have it returned within a very short period of time. The other interesting thing about the Kenai is that there's an innovative cost share program between Fish and Game and U.S. Fish and Wildlife, which is the carrot and the stick approach. But it's the carrot approach for property owners to do the right thing for riparian habitat on their properties. They get up to 50% of the cost of installation and cost of the infrastructure to put up light penetrating walkways on their walkways. So if you go up and down the Kenai River, you will see all these walkways within the area there where property owners can go and enjoy bank fishing or getting in and out of their boats. That is not cheap. It was interesting when we were talking with former Representative Jay Ramirez about what it cost. He was saying, along my banks up there in Fairbanks, I got a lot of people looking at the river. I'm kind of looking. There's some damage there. What does that cost? $2,000 to put those walkways that we have down on the Kenai? No, it's typically the tab is anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 to $50,000 to $100,000. That's what it takes to repair and show commitment to doing the right thing. And so that cost share program, there have been over 500 properties along the Kenai River who have participated in the cost share program. We've been proud to support that program financially and otherwise, and that's a really wonderful program. So sport fishing, why is it an upstart industry in Alaska? Few people realize it's a $1.4 billion industry in Alaska. It's a huge, huge number, but it's emerged in a short period of time. It supports 16,000 jobs, and it generates $125 million in state and local tax revenues. What's interesting in terms of the tourism industry, it generates about 40% of the state tourism revenues. So when you look at all the revenues that tourism brings in to the state, about 40% of those will be associated with the activity of sport fishing. Only 1 in 5 visitors coming to Alaska will buy a sport fishing license, but those 20% of people are generating about 40% of the revenue. It's a textbook value-added industry. If you're going to study something in terms of how can you add value as an industry in Alaska, and I would say sport fishing is a poster child for value-added industries for our state. Sport fishing uses less than 5% of the salmon that are harvested in the state, uses less than 10% of the halibut harvest, and those between salmon and halibut, that's over 80% of what sport fishing people are fishing for. The other 10% divvied up amongst other species, mainly rainbow trout. Similar economics values are generated through sport fishing, has economic values similar to the commercial uses of that, that take 95% of the salmon, 90% of the halibut, and 100% of all other commercially harvested species if you back out the Bering Sea pollock fishery. So that's the size and value of the sport fishing industry when we compare it to the commercial fishing industry in Alaska. And that's why sport fishing has a seat at the table, both at the Board of Fisheries process in Alaska and at the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. So I'll go through about 10 slides here, just to kind of give a graphical idea of just what I said. So total sport fishing expenditures, there was a study done in 2007 that will be repeated in 2013. $1.4 billion of expenditures in 2007 off of about 2.5 million angler days. If you notice how much activity is spent by residents, by people in this room and throughout Alaska, residents spend about $733 million. It's a little more than half of the spending of sport fishing in the state. Non-residents, $650 million. That's the 40% of the tourism spending in the state of Alaska. You can see where it's broken up. The majority of sport fishing and angler days are spent in South Central Alaska. There's over a million angler days by residents just right here in South Central. The interior has a little bit, and Southeast has more. You can see Southeast non-residents are important. That's why we have contentious issues in the Southeast fisheries between our longline fishermen and our commercial industry and our charter boat industry, both seeking to use the same resource and hopefully trying to figure out how to do that effectively so that we get some win-win situations. Again, just another way to look at it. You can see in South Central here, it's close to a billion-dollar industry. In Cook Inlet, a subset of this, it's about it's over $800 million that are just spent in Cook Inlet. You look at categories. I was talking about the $1 billion along the Kenai River in terms of property values. Fishing-related real estate expenditures are over $100 million a year in Alaska. So if you look at the left side of the graph, the yellow and the red, that's primarily the residential spending. And if you look at the right side, the green and the blue, that's primarily the non-resident spending. This is what economic surveys tell you. They break it out, give you all Alaska fishing combined. It's about $275 per day. Residents only is about $150 per day. Non-residents, of course, are $450, about three times the amount of what residents spend. You break it out into saltwater trips, and you can break it out into unguided and guided trips. So what's nice about this type of data is then you can match it up if you want to understand what an individual fishery is. You can look at the angler days, you have a multiplier, and you can start calculating what the value of different fisheries are. Here's some facts and figures just about, you know, kind of what we were saying. Alaskans fish more than non-residents in the state. Makes sense. We're here. We can go fishing more often. So the majority of angler days in Alaska are actually by residents. Where do we fish? South Central. You know, that kind of matches up with the population of Alaska, the population distribution. About 70% of Alaskans live in the South Central region. take a little second, talk a little bit about what makes Upper Cook Inlet fishing different. It's unique, the values of sport and personal use fishing, unlike other areas in the state, are greater than our commercial fisheries in Cook Inlet, and it makes management in Cook Inlet different. In Cook Inlet, through the Board of Fisheries process, we have the most complex management plans anywhere in the state, probably anywhere in the world. We're trying to balance personal use, sport, commercial fisheries, subsistence fisheries for reds, kings, silvers, are the three primary ones, also with pink salmon and chum salmon. So the proportion of Alaska fishing trips occurring in Upper Cook Inlet on the left-hand side for all species, half of all fishing in Alaska for sport fishing happens in Upper Cook Inlet. All other locations are less than half. And for salmon in Upper Cook Inlet, it's about 37% of all the trips. So this is a major, major component of what we're fishing for in this region here. I want to contrast that with the Upper Cook Inlet proportion of statewide commercial salmon harvests. Upper Cook Inlet is about 2% of the harvest of our commercial fisheries in the state. Though that 2%, though, is an important component of our commercial harvest, but I just wanted to point out the relative harvest of Cook Inlet, Upper Cook Inlet, compared to the rest of the state. Another interesting thing is the number of commercial salmon permits fished for every 100,000 fish harvested. You can see relative to the rest of the state, Cook Inlet has, we have two types of fisheries. We have set net fisheries and drift fisheries. Other parts of the state, we're throwing in seine fisheries, but we have a lot more commercial fishermen here harvesting a smaller numbers of fish per permit than we do in the rest of Alaska. But we also continue to harvest, so the sport and personal use fisheries harvest about 20% of the salmon in Upper Cook Inlet, and our commercial fisheries harvest about 80%. And then when you look at the annual average jobs and income generated by salmon fishing, that's what you get. You have jobs and income through recreational salmon fishing compared with Upper Cook Inlet. Now, this is not to say that commercial fishing in Cook Inlet is not important. It's very important. It's very important in our community. Jobs are important in our community. But this is what makes Upper Cook Inlet different. It's what makes it unique in management throughout the state. And that's why we have contentious battles at the Board of Fisheries. The commercial fishermen primarily are fishing for sockeye. They want to, you know, that's the bread and butter fish. Over 90% of the values are generated through red salmon. Last year, there was $50 million in ex-vessel value for the sockeye fishery. Record year. It was a good year for commercial fishing, which is very positive. Yet the other species that are important for sport fishing harvest, the king and the coho salmon, generated less than $500,000. And so what we're trying to do is figure out in these mosaics of fisheries, how do we get to win-win situations with our commercial, sport, and personal use fisheries here in Upper Cook Inlet.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Ricky Gies, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. He was recorded speaking at an Alaska Resource Development Council breakfast on May 17th.
That being said, I'm going to switch gears now, and I'm going to start talking a couple things I've noticed since I've come on board as my first year on board of the Resource Development Council. I want to talk my thoughts on resource management councils in fisheries as a model for industry and regional decision-making. And I want to talk about wise use, conservation versus no use environmentalism, and then focus in on the Kenai and the state in terms of sport fishing needs for our future. So Alaska Resource Management Councils for Fisheries, I think everybody should have one as a model for resource development in the state. This is probably where I'm angling for controversy. Case example, fisheries in Alaska. I don't know if people understand how fisheries are managed in Alaska. I'll just give a little brief introduction and history of it. The state level, prior to statehood, the feds and government managed fisheries in Alaska. and they were managed basically into the crown. So when fisheries came with statehood in the 1960s, Alaska took a very different approach for fisheries management. And fisheries management, the allocation and the sustainability of fisheries is done through the Alaska Board of Fisheries. It's a 7-member panel. It's a lay panel. And it has interests in commercial fishing, sport fishing, subsistence users, personal use. And it's a very, very public process. It's probably one of the most open and transparent public-generated, public-driven processes that there are anywhere in resource development in the world. But it's driven by industry, not government. So the allocation of the resources is all done on the Board of Fisheries level. Every 3 years, the Board of Fish comes to a different region of the state, and we hash out commercial fishing, sport fishing, personal use, and subsistence issues. But it's done by the users and the industry and not government. Government plays a supporting role, not the defining role, not the lead dog role. So government implements the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We've got a couple employees, Mr. Hepler and Jennifer there. We have that once the directives are given by the Board of Fisheries, it's the responsibility of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to execute those management plans. So in this realm, the head coach are the users and the industry. And that's very different than the models I see in other resources in Alaska. I'm just pointing out, I just want to point that out. And on the federal level, one of the geniuses of the Magnuson-Stevenson Act is it duplicates that same model that Alaska pioneered on the federal level throughout federal fisheries in the country. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council allocates the resources. You basically, I mean, no offense to the commercial fishing industry here, but you basically have to be a user, a major user, in order to get on the council. And I'm not saying that as a negative thing. I'm saying that as a good thing. Industry allocates the resources. There's about over 25 different fisheries that are managed by the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. And that's done by industry. That's not done by the National Marine Fisheries Service. That's done by industry. And that's a good thing. Government, NIMS, implements the recommendations and the vision of industry. And how refreshing would that be for forestry, mining, oil and gas, tourism in the state of Alaska and elsewhere in our country and in the world? So, resource management councils for fisheries, everybody should have one. Why are they effective? One, decision-making is local and regional. It's not from on high from Washington, D.C. It's a very open and transparent process. Anybody in this room can go to the North Council. Anybody in this room can go to the Alaska Board of Fisheries, and if you have an idea, it's going to get a public vetting. Maybe not what you like. Plenty of times with sport fishing, you know, we have an idea, gets knocked around, gets shot down. Plenty of times Chip there has put stuff in for the North Council or the Alaska Board of Fisheries, thinks it's a great idea, might get shot out of the water. Then again, it might be approved. Paul has had many, many ideas put before the board. Some float, some don't. The other thing that's interesting is Alaska is pretty unique, at least on the state level. Throughout the state, we have local advisory councils, advisory committees that vet ideas and talk about ideas on the local level before they bubble up to the board process. Very, very different than many, many other resource models out there. And you know what? We don't get sued all the time. I was at the Resource Development Council meeting yesterday, and they were going around the room, how's your industry? How's your industry doing? How's your industry doing? Every one of them was raising their hand about, we had this plan, this is our plans for development, and we're getting sued. Oh, yeah, and by the way, we're getting sued. And the people who weren't getting sued, they were saying, oh, yeah, we have these ideas, we're doing this. And the people who are getting sued were laughing at those people because who weren't getting sued because they will get sued. In the fishing industry, the only people who sue each other in the fishing industry is industry. Greenpeace and the Defenders of Wildlife are amazingly absent in fisheries management in Alaska. And the reason is it's a very open and transparent process. And if they want to talk, they come to the Board of Fisheries and they come to the North Council and they make their ideas. And they don't really get very far. And because it's a public process and because the process is set in such a way, it makes it very, very difficult to sue because process is followed and it's a public process and it's with public participation. Very, very open and transparent process. Again, so it's stakeholder and industry driven. Industry sets sustainability levels and allocates and government implements. Now, what is that left? Fisheries management in Alaska, whether it's on the state level or on the federal level, is recognized as one of the best managed fisheries anywhere in the world. And we don't get lawsuits, and industry is at the table in the leadership. Now, that should be a role model for other industries in Alaska, in our country, in the world. Let me talk a little bit about wise use conservation versus no use environmentalism. I did go to Stanford, and one of my professors was Mr. Ehrlich, who said, you know, by the time I turned 30, there was going to be too many people in the world. There was going to be mass famines and mass starvation. Well, we're all here, world's still pumping along, and we're still rolling. About every 10 years, I've heard some new environmental claim that this world is not going to keep turning. It's not going to keep spinning. But there's an older model that I want to talk about, and it's resource conservation, and it's the North American model for fishing game management. And it's had over 100 years of success. And it's based on wise use, and it's based on the knowledge and the notion that if you're a user of fish and game resources in North America, you're going to buy a license, and you're going to pay for the privilege of going out and hunting and fishing. And with that money, we're going to fund conservation. It's a user-based model. So for 100 years, where I grew up in Wisconsin, we would go out deer hunting. I think we have like the world's eighth largest army in Wisconsin when we go out deer hunting each year. But that army pays for fish and game management in Wisconsin. Just like the Army in Illinois, the Army in Michigan, the Army in Pennsylvania, the deer hunters pay for, through their license fees and tags, fish and game management in the state. Same thing in Alaska. The best thing you can do if you want to say that you're a conservationist is to go out and buy an Alaska, not just a fishing license with your $10 king stamp, buy a hunting license and buy a trapping license. For $72, you can get all three with your king stamp, and that's the best thing you can do for conservation in Alaska. Not only that, you can encourage all your friends and family who come to Alaska and visit to go the max on the non-resident licenses, and that's only about $500. So supersize what your friends and family do when they come to Alaska and help support fish and game management that we have here. Now contrast that to what I call the no-use propaganda. It's the encroaching wilderness model that government and NGOs know best. That people disconnected from the resource will know how to better manage the resource than the actual users of the resource. And many times they'll bring no money to the table. And they'll tell people who want to use a resource that they can't use a resource. No use is the idea, is the ideal. Human use is to be thought of as contamination. What's interesting is that in our world today, I studied ecology at school, have been around the world, looked at many different national parks, state parks, models, and you know where they don't have problems with endangered species? For elephants and tigers and rare deer and exotic animals in North America is where people hunt them. The best thing for an endangered species in this world today, it's kind of a strange comment, strange thought, is if somebody cares enough to kill it. Now, I know that's kind of a crazy, wild thing to say, but it's true. In Texas, where they have exotic farms, we have endangered species that have 10, 20,000 numbers, no longer endangered in North America, genetic resource, a genetic reserve. Noah's Ark are hunting game units around the world. Where you don't have hunters, you have poachers, and you have extinctions. And in the 20th and 21st century, I will always pit the wise use model for conservation against the no use model. But the problem is, once species go endangered and extinct, they're extinct. And many times in our world today, whether it's tigers or elephants or whatever game species it is, hunters are the one footing the bill and ensuring that these species survive throughout the world. That ethic creeps down on the Kenai. We deal with it, and I just want to talk a little bit about motors and people on the Kenai River. Some people think there should be no motor on the Kenai River. Some people think there are too many people on the Kenai River, that we should just close the doors, and actually nobody should be on the Kenai River because it's the river and we love it. The wise use that we have on the Kenai is a mosaic pattern of multiple uses. On the upper river, we have drift-only fisheries. On the lower and middle river, we have power boats and drift boats. On the Kasilof, we have drift boats. We have bank fisheries. We have boat fisheries. We have fisheries in May, June, July, August, September, October, November, and there'd be people out there in February and March drilling holes, you know, ice fishing. But according to the no-use crowd, there should be no motors on the Kenai. We should rip apart that mosaic, and there's too many people, and we should close the door, and we shouldn't put infrastructure in, and we shouldn't encourage people to come, and it should be crappy. You know, you should sit in line for an hour trying to get on the river because we only want one or two public boat launches there. In the last two decades, we've had to sit through a 35-horsepower discussion. We've had to hear discussions about boat wakes, about how damaging they are, about hydrocarbon issues, now about turbidity issues. Every one of those, all four of those studies right there have been to the tune collectively of over millions of dollars. 35 horsepower was somebody pulled it out of the air without any research. 35 horsepower is about the worst horsepower motor that you can have for a boat because it doesn't allow you to get on step and it produces, almost by design, maximum wakes. When we moved up to a 50 horsepower motor that they actually sell, you have boats now on step and not creating the maximum wake. We've had boat wake studies. We had, you know, two or three boat wake studies trying to show that boat wakes are the death of habitat along the Kenai River. There's boat wakes, definitely. Power boats definitely impact, you know, have an effect on the banks. But you know what? So does 10 feet of ice annually every year scouring out along the sides, and so do major floods. The Army Corps of Engineers indicated that 90 to 95% of the movement along the banks of the Kenai River, the scouring, are natural phenomenon. Yeah, 5, 10% it comes from boat wakes, but it's not the major driver. So if we're going to have use, it's going to have some impacts. It's not going to have no impact. It's going to have some, but it allows a huge industry and large numbers of people to get on and off that river safely. People want to have drift boats only on the Kenai in the lower section where you have 10 to 15,000 CFS per, you know, in July. It would probably be the most dangerous fishery that we would have in the state. So we've had people who have tried to block infrastructure and improvements as a deterrent to stymie having a world-class welcoming in terms of facilities of people getting on and off the river. And that's what we deal with the no-use crowd on the Kenai. It's interesting, we just had a Kenai River use study. Multiple users all talking about their issues. All of them saying, hey, you know, these people should be doing something. Not me, but those people, you know. So multiple use is good. You get everybody pointing fingers at each other. But they're all in agreement. We need infrastructure. We need toilets. We need pullouts. We need places to deal with fish carcasses, you know, restrooms, boat launches, bank facilities to go angling on. Everybody agreed. We need the infrastructure in order to do it well. And that's what we do. That's what we support, is the wise use of our resource on the Kenai River. So sport fishing, definitely we have some needs, continuing needs. We're a young industry in Alaska. We have growing pains. It's important. It's important for the quality of life of our residents and our visitors. And here's something that should be a wake-up call for people. By 2035, an additional 200,000 people will live in Alaska, probably in Anchorage, the Matsu, and on the Kenai Peninsula. A lot of them will like to fish. So this idea that we're going to turn the Kenai River back into some sort of long ago, rare and nobody's going to be around when I'm out there, that's gone. And we're going to continue to have to figure out how to manage this world-class resource with world-class commitment by Alaskans, for Alaskans, and the rest of the world. I want to say thanks for Senator McGuire for sponsoring SB 24 for us. We're trying to get a professional sport fishing guide services board in the state. Again, based on the model that industry can take care of itself, help manage itself. There's a lot of different, when I was in the tourism industry, I'd always get calls, hey, I came up here, I spent $5,000-$10,000, and you know, I got shystered. You know, I'm living in a cardboard shack and come down here and, you know, have a thumb, gotta, you know, take my thumb and 10 miles off. And you know, usually the guide industry is pretty good. When they hear that's happened, they'll put people on. But you know what? There's nothing currently in our regs right now that will prevent that person from not getting a guide license again. And that's one of the main reasons why we would like to see a professional guide services board that says, if you are vulgar and abuse of what you're providing, you're out. You don't get another license. So I just want to say thanks, Senator McGuire, for helping us out on that. The other thing that I think we need in terms of sport fishing personal use is a timeline, kind of like the STIP program for roads. We need the same type of commitment and infrastructure and planning processes in our government on local and state level that will give us a strategic prioritized investments for not just the Kenai River, but the Kisilof, Deep Creek, Anchor Point, up here in the Matsu, in Anchorage, in Fairbanks, in Southeast. We don't have a program like that. We're not organized. We don't know how much infrastructure we need. The Kenai Bings Landing needs about $2 million just to get up off the feet and accommodate the new users, the sockeye salmon users, get parking lots, get better boat launches, get better infrastructure to go fishing. When that comes up in bills, you know, it's kind of, what are we doing this for? You get in front of the Senate or House Finance Committee, they don't know if this is important or not important. So it becomes hit or miss. We've tried since I've started working at Kenai River Sport Fishing, just to get a takeout on the lower Kisilof River. It's taken 8 years, be 10 years by the time it gets done. We have a public put in for drift boats, and we want to keep it a drift boat fishery, but there's no public takeout. Now, how smart is that in terms of smart management? Not very. So with a STIP program, we'd like to see that change in government. And for our government officials here, I would really like to see somebody take that idea and run with it so we get positive budgets and improvements and planning processes. And I also say, I think it's time for Alaskans to buck up and pay user fees that we did when we became a state. 1960, adjusted for inflation, our sport fish license in the state should be about $75. That's what we paid when we decided that we wanted to be a state and be big people and manage our resources. And today hasn't been adjusted for inflation, and we still pay $20-$25 for a sport fish license fee as a state. It's time that we get some more money to pay for the investments that we need to be smart with our industry. On the Kenai, when you ask government officials to, hey, can we get something to deal with the fish waste management? Can we get something to deal with the trash cans? Can we get more restroom facilities? Where's the money going to come from? And again, I think we should fall back on the wise use model. And I think whether it's a regional model or a state model, just like we have a King Salmon stamp that helps pay for the $1 million a year that it costs to monitor King Salmon coming into the Kenai River, I think it's time for a sockeye stamp for our state. We have, it's the largest single use of our resource in the state in terms of fish and game resources by residents. And I think it's time that we ask residents to pitch in so that we can have facilities, so that we can quit the bickering of having inadequate infrastructure, no parking lots, no restroom facilities, no place to put your fish carcasses once you get them. A friend of mine said when he went down to the Kasiloff River, hey, if there's no parking lots, I can park anywhere. If there's no restrooms, I can go anywhere. And if there's no place for me to deal with my fish carcasses, I can throw them anywhere. And that attitude we need to change. We can do better than that. And that's what I encourage us all to think about and all to do, and that's what we're about. So if you want to help us in our efforts to continue to support wise use for sport fishing and personal use fishing in the state of Alaska, your support of wise use is important. And over the last 20 years, industry in the state, many of you around the table today come to our Kenai River Classic event in July, help support our Kenai River Junior Classic event in August. And many of the professional women in the room are know about and have heard about and attend our Kenai River Women's Classic. So I encourage you to become a sponsor of sustainability on the Kenai and elsewhere. If you want to learn more and get involved, www.krsa.com. Join and support CRISA. And above all else, this summer, pick up a rod and reel, go fishing, take your family and friends, and have fun.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Ricky Gies, Executive Director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. He was recorded speaking at an Alaska Resource Development Council breakfast on May 17, 2012. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Addressing Alaskans' theme song, Trampolines, is by Patrick Lee. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.